88.1. It's Maryland Morning. Happy Holiday, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to the January edition of Living Questions, our monthly series in which we examine the role of religion in the public sphere. We're producing this series in partnership with the Institute for Christian and Jewish Studies. Today, on this Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, a conversation about the nonviolence movement with one of the founders of Jonah House, a community whose pillars are nonviolence, resistance, and community. Jonah House was founded in 1973 by Elizabeth McAllister, a former Catholic nun, and her husband, Philip Berrigan, a former Catholic priest who was a member of the Baltimore Four and the Catonsville Nine. In 1968, the Catonsville Nine burned draft records as a protest against the Vietnam War, setting off a series of draft board protests around the country. I'm here today with Elizabeth McAllister at Jonah House, which is located at St. Peter's Cemetery in West Baltimore. Elizabeth McAllister, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Take us back to 1973, and you and your husband founded this community. What were your aspirations back then?
We had come out of years of resistance to the war in Vietnam, and we had recently been through the Harrisburg conspiracy trial in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and we realized in the midst of that trial that people who did draft board actions, and by the way, they started with Phil and Tom Lewis and a couple of others, doing an action at the Customs House here in Baltimore, pouring blood on draft records. And he was sentenced to 6 years in prison based on that. And then the Catonsville Nine occurred, and that was even more celebrated. And the two charges came together, and he served prison time he served 39 months of his six-year sentence at that point. But they were the beginnings of a whole series of draft board actions. In taking action, people always talked about stepping into a life of resistance. And I believe people were very sincere about that, but we didn't have a clue what it meant. Nobody much had a clue what it meant. And as we went through the Harrisburg trial, we realized that most of the people who had done those actions had moved on in their lives and were elsewhere. And that we hadn't learned enough about sustaining resistance, and that the formula for that had to be in something like community. So the notion of forming community and basing it on nonviolence and resistance and community seemed to be, if not the answer, it's a road to something like an answer. So after a year of preparation, we moved to Baltimore and began here.
So these three pillars that you referred to, nonviolence, resistance, and community, they really are interdependent. One relies on the other.
I think that's very true. Yeah. I don't think you can sustain. You can do resistance periodically, but you can't sustain it.
How has the nonviolence movement, in your view, changed and evolved since the time that you founded Jonah House back in the 70s?
Well, I think that where we see it most lived out is with many of the Catholic worker communities who do live not only nonviolence and community, but also resistance and poverty, you know, simple lifestyle and poverty. And a powerful amount of intercooperation is involved in that. And one of the things that has come out of all of that, aside from the whole series of plowshares actions, has been this Witness Against Torture group. Back in 2007, I think, the group went down to Cuba and walked to Guantanamo and had a fast and vigil as close to the prison as they could get. And ever since have had this consistent presence every January for the closing of Guantanamo. And the resistance and the nonviolence and the prayer life and the sense of community there is really, really intense. And I've been doing some thinking about Martin Luther King and thinking especially of the powerful community that surrounded him and how that hasn't been held up, I think, in recent years. You know, I think of Vincent Harding, who literally wrote the speech that Martin Luther King gave at Riverside. I think of Bayard Rustin, who did most of the organizing, you know, around the bus boycott.
The Riverside speech, we should remind folks, was about the Vietnam War.
Yes. Martin Luther King changed the one sentence in that whole speech, and otherwise, that was the work of Vincent Harding. Now, that's incredible humility on the part of Harding. And, you know, I think of Harry Belafonte and the way that he supported this whole movement. And I guess seeing Selma and this movie where they can't even quote him because the family owns these talks is, in my view, an incredible violation of that powerful sense of community that existed there. Vincent Harding never claimed that speech. And Bayard Rustin wasn't looking for kudos from anybody. He just wanted to do what he could do. And Harry Belafonte continued to give and to give and to give and to be present, even though he couldn't even be present at Mrs. King's funeral because the Bushes were there. And there's a lot that's very, very monkey in all of this for me, and I hope we can all learn a little bit from it.
On 88.1, it's Marilyn Morning. You're listening to our series on religion and ethics called Living Questions. My guest this morning, Liz McAllister, one of the founders of Jonah House, a nonviolent community in West Baltimore. And of course, the fissures in the nonviolent movement began, even in Dr. King's lifetime, it began in a way with that Riverside speech, because people were saying, why are you worrying about the Vietnam War? Go back to civil rights.
Yes.
Have those fissures, it seems like they have continued. And I wonder, is there a place that it's being taken up? For example, is the Occupy movement a successor to the civil rights and to the nonviolence movements of the 60s and 70s?
I thought Occupy had a lot of hope connected with it. I don't see it continuing. You see little uplifts of it, but I don't see it being what people hoped it would be. I was in great admiration for those who gave so much of their time and their lives and their sweat and discomfort. I mean, this is not a comfortable way to live, camping out. And there they were in the cities and repeatedly being arrested. And in Oakland, they suffered hugely, you know, and elsewhere. But I didn't in any way see that as a follow-up to the movement that Martin Luther King was so responsible for continuing to build on. And I really don't see that being picked up on. As I say, what I see and relate to is the Catholic workers and that resistance, and focusing on the war and focusing on the weapons and tying in with the black communities that have suffered so much at the hands of police. And that's a reality. That's a reality, and we know it.
And do you think that the recent situations in Ferguson and Staten Island and Cleveland will reinvigorate then that movement? It certainly has very much, you know, gotten involved a lot more people in protests. Do you think it could perhaps reinvigorate the nonviolent movement in particular?
Well, I want to refer to an amazing black woman named Ruby Sales, who has a peace group down. She's centered in Columbus, Georgia. And it's called Spirit House. And she organized an action in D.C. before the killings out in, well, Ferguson had happened, but the New York killing had not happened. But she had names of 1,000 young African Americans killed by police since 2007. And in the course of that witness, we read all those 1,000 names. She has been involved all her life, and at age 17, and probably now she's 60s, 70s, but at age 17, she was doing voter registration down in Mississippi and was arrested with a group of people. They were held a number of days and then just thrown out of jail, as is pretty typical in the middle of the summer. So they called, I guess they found a phone and put in a call to their support people, but waiting, they were thirsty and went into this corner store for a cold drink. And she was standing in front of Jonathan Daniels, a seminarian from New Hampshire who had been down working with them, and a humongous cop, a sheriff's deputy, is standing there with his shotgun. And he says to her, "I'm going to blow your brains out." And with that, she felt a hand on her shoulder, and Jonathan Daniels took the bullet and was killed. She was mute. She was mute until she testified at that trial as to what had happened. But she has continued from that day to this, since she's in her 70s and can barely walk at this point.
And when did that horrible incident take place?
That incident, I would guess 50s.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. 50s.
One, of course, the fundamental tenets of a nonviolent life is that violence is never an appropriate response
to anything.
How do you answer those folks who say, but we live in a violent world. We have the Islamic State, mm-hmm. ISIS, Boko mm-hmm. Haram. We have violence being perpetrated, you know, in Paris and mm-hmm. against mm-hmm. innocents mm-hmm. All over the world, Nigeria. Yeah. How does one confront violence without violence?
You take it. And if it means your death, you take that too, as Jonathan Daniels did. And he was down there, a white seminarian from New Hampshire. And they loved him. They loved him because he embodied it. He embodied what they were trying to learn, and he was trying to learn. We're all always trying to learn it, and we all fail sometimes. Mm-hmm. But you try to learn from those mistakes.
If you had the chance to speak to the head of ISIS or Boko Haram, what would you say? How would you try to be persuasive to that person to stop the violence that mm-hmm. person so obviously embraces?
Mm-hmm. I think I would ask them to look back on what it's accomplishing in their countries, among their people, and in their own hearts. And if they think they're better now than they were when they got into it. And that kind of reflection is absolutely essential. And it's got to happen every single day, you know.
Elizabeth McAllister is one of the founders of Jonah House, a faith-based community of people who have for more than 40 years advanced the notion of nonviolence as a way of life. We've got a link to more information about Jonah House on our website, as well as a link to information about a book written by Frida Berrigan, one of Liz McAllister's three children. It's called It Runs in the Family, on being raised by radicals and growing into rebellious motherhood. Frida Berrigan and I will be talking about that book on an upcoming program, but you can catch a sneak peek and hear other conversations in our Living Questions series when you come over to wypr.org/livingquestions. That's it for this edition of Living Questions, our monthly series in which we examine the role of religion in the public sphere. The series is produced by WYPR in conjunction with the Institute for Christian and Jewish Studies. Reporting from West Baltimore on 88.1, I'm Tom Hall.